Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Dear 2020, can we just start over? I'm Dawn O'Porter and I've been thinking about life in lockdown, mostly from a cupboard. My new book, Life in Pieces, is full of thoughts on everything from bad hair and parenting to things we can control and the things we can't. When everything's falling apart, we'll piece it back together. Life in Pieces is out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.
Hi, I'm Dawn O'Porter and welcome to So Lucky, my new podcast where each week I go deep with my guest and explore all of the sides to all of their stories, the highs and lows, their hopes and fears, their lucky and their unlucky moments. My guest this week is Matt Haig, the number one best-selling author of Reasons to Stay Alive, which if you hadn't read, you must. And of course, Notes on a Nervous Planet, as well as six highly acclaimed novels for adults and many more books for children. Matt and I talked about how being a mental health ambassador is a ridiculous thing, being grateful for things that you never would have thought you'd be grateful for, the population size of doomsday villages, stay with me, and looking forward to rejection letters. Now, only someone like Matt Haig could say that. I can't say I've ever looked forward to rejection letters. I loved this conversation and I hope you do too. So here is me, Dawn O'Porter, talking to the wonderful Matt Haig.
I've started reading your book, Dawn.
Oh.
And I'm loving it. It's so funny.
Thank you, darling. Thank you very much.
It's so hard to write like that and just be so natural and funny. It's really good.
Oh, I really appreciate that. I absolutely love it. I'm really proud of it and I'm very excited for it to come out. Obviously, you're my guest, so I'm going to speak to you about you, unless you want to ask me loads of questions and take the pressure off, and that's absolutely fine. But no, I think ideally I'm going to ask you the questions. Your book, Reasons to Stay Alive, is one of the most beautiful pieces of nonfiction I think I've ever read.
Oh, thank you.
I heard about you talking about kind of why you wrote it and how it was a bit of a side thought and wasn't supposed to be a big thing. And now it's this big thing. Mm. Is there a part of you that thinks, I wish I didn't have to talk about this everywhere I went?
Yeah, I'm getting past that a little bit. But for a while, it wasn't so much that. It wasn't so much that sort of getting bored of talking about it. It was more that I'd been a real, like, I'd written like 10 books before that, Mom. And I'd been the sort of archetypal struggling writer. Well, lucky enough to get published, but, you know, a bit under the radar. And then Reasons to Stay Alive was my biggest book, which is great. But because it was that book and because it was about me and it was about the worst time of my life and it was about my parents were in it and real people were in it, my wife was in it. And it was quite a transition from no one at all having heard of you really to people starting to hear about you, but every time you're having to literally be like in a therapist's office talking about
and,
the most.
And you just probably is not a particularly outgoing person. Suddenly everybody knows you so intimately and that must feel a little bit, why did I do that to
myself?
I know,
but I'm weird. I don't know if, I suppose I am an introvert in some ways. Like, I'm bad at eye contact now and I'm bad at certain things, but like when I'm writing, I'm not.
Okay.
So I don't know why. I know people read books and they read, you know, if you're writing a tweet or whatever, but somehow I get into a zone where I feel like they're not. And so I write as if no one is watching, even though you're writing for someone to read it. Uh-huh. So it's a weird paradox. But yeah, in a weird way, I'm quite shameless when I'm writing.
Yeah, I can
relate to
that.
And then I have to talk about it. Yeah.
But then also, is there something about, like, if I could have my perfect argument with my husband, it would be on email, because I know that I'm going to have said everything I need to say the way that I want to say it. So if you write a very personal book like you did,
yeah,
is part of the kind of confidence of going out there with it and having all these conversations is that you know that you've said everything you need to say about it and everyone's read your feelings. It's not like you've got stones unturned or you didn't quite get those words in a conversation.
Yes, that's true. Although with social media, sometimes right, it's sort of somewhere in between, isn't it? It's sort of you are writing it, but you're not necessarily editing it or thinking mm-hmm. about what you're putting. And especially in these heated political times, like on Twitter, I'll just like fire some random thing off.
Yes.
And but because you're like, inverted commas, a professional person, or now I get called like a mental health ambassador. Like ambassador is a ridiculous thing. Or, you know, this thing where you've got to have some sort of responsibility and you never asked to have that responsibility.
Well, that's what I mean. Is there a part of you that it's yeah. feeling like, oh God, I didn't quite mean for this to happen.
Totally.
Almost like the Oracle.
Yeah. But when the paperback came out and it was number one, it was doing really well. And I'd never had a book and like had sold anywhere near that many copies in a week and stuff. I was having the worst time of my life. Well, not the worst time of my mm-hmm. life, because the worst time of my life was what I was writing about in Reasons to Stay Alive. I was having one of the worst times of my life because I was having anxiety uh-huh. and I was in a bit of a dip myself. Suddenly everyone's talking about, you know, this self-help story where I'd got apparently better and people were contacting me as if I was a doctor or a therapist or
right,
a Samaritan.
Right, okay.
And I was sort of like pacing around my living room in circles, hardly even able to walk around the corner to Tesco Metro. Mm-hmm. So I was feeling a little bit, A, hypocritical, a bit of a fraud. I'd written this sort of book, which was apparently was helping people, and that I was like, well, why can't my own advice help me?
Right.
So I was having that total crisis for a while. But I've come to terms with all that, absorbed it all. I'm grateful I've written it. If you know, out of every, it's definitely not my best written book,
yeah.
I don't think. But out of every book I've written, I would say that would be the one. If there was only one that I'd keep, it would be that one. Because, you know, it's nice to be useful to people. And I think what people are helped by it, not because I've got all the answers.
Yes.
They're helped by it because they feel less alone in what is a very lonely and alienating experience.
Very true, but also something I was discussing with someone this morning as I was talking about you, which I have been talking about you for a few days now, because that seems to happen when people consume your work. I've not suffered from depression, but I have someone very close to me who does. And reading your book just made me realise how to be there for her. It's going to change everything in our relationship, the way that my frustrations with her, the way that I try to fix her, all of these things, the things that I would say is like, come on, you can just. And you made me fully understand it as an illness. And therefore, I would say that it's as important for the people going through it who feel alone as it is for the people who know people who are going through it and what to say. Anyway, I am the podcast that we are on today, excellent podcasting, this show is about the concept of luck.
Yes.
And out of everybody, I think you're the person who I'm most interested to hear the answer to this question because of everything that you've been through. But I was hoping, if you don't mind, if I could just read one of your lists from the book.
Okay.
Do you know what? Can you read it? Because it's kind of always amazing. So yeah.
Okay, I'll read it. Things that have happened to me that have generated more sympathy than depression. Having tinnitus. Scalding my hand on an oven and having to have my hand in a strange ointment-filled glove for a week. Accidentally setting my leg on fire. Losing a job. Breaking a toe. Being in debt. Having a river flood our nice new house, causing £10,000 worth of damage. Bad Amazon reviews. Getting the norovirus. Having to be circumcised when I was 11. Lower back pain. Having a blackboard fall on me. Irritable bowel syndrome. Being a street away from a terrorist attack. Eczema. Living in Hull in January. Relationship breakups. Working in a cabbage packing warehouse. To be fair, that was also Hull. Uh-huh. Working in media sales. Okay, that came close. consuming a poisoned prawn, 3-day migraines.
Right. Considering that list and everything else that you've talked about with mental health and depression, do you consider yourself to be a lucky person?
Yes, I do. That hasn't always been the case, and it might not be the case in the future, but at the moment, I consider myself a lucky person.
Why?
Well, firstly, and not to be too sentimental about it, because I'm alive, mm-hmm. at an age which I didn't think I'd reach. I know 44 is hardly Yoda, but I felt at 24 that I wouldn't make it to 25. So I'm lucky that I'm here and living a future I didn't think I would get to, and also a kind of future that even if I thought I would still be alive, that I wouldn't be having. I feel grateful for things that when I was younger, I didn't feel grateful for.
Mm-hmm. You know, like what?
Well, when I was, I suppose it's normal young man stuff, but when I was in my early 20s, everything had to be like the loudest volume, the spiciest foods, most extreme novels, most, right. you know, Tarantino, everything. Everything had to be sort of like full blown. And now, you know, things that I'd have once found boring are just being or just looking at the sea in Brighton or just sort of going for a walk with a dog. I like neutrality now. I'm sort of grateful for just living and inhaling and exhaling and all of that stuff. So that was definitely something I once didn't have. I didn't have that sort of gratitude. I was always sort of more, everything, everything. And yeah, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for my work. I'm grateful for Andrea still being with me. She's obviously, she had been through some stuff with me, yes. in the early years. And we're still together remarkably. We've got children.
How old are your children now?
11 and 10, Pearl and Lucas. And yeah, it's not all good, obviously, because it's life, but it's all reasons to be grateful for things.
And how good are you at spinning a scenario to appreciate the luck of it? So we go back to that list that you just read out, and I'm going to use quite a, what must have been traumatizing example, but being a street away from a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
Are you able to say, I was just lucky to be a street away? Because since having my second child, around 5 to 6 months after having him, I developed my first ever anxiety issue, and it was really overwhelming and quite frightening. And I just was unable to see that. Well, for example, I was at a friend's house. I'm there with my 18-month-old, so he's kind of running around, and I think he's playing in the living room, and suddenly I realise he's not, and I'm like, where the hell is he? And there's no cover on the pool. So I run outside, and he's standing about 6 feet away from the pool, and that mother's instinct.
Yeah.
At that moment had made me run outside. Nothing bad happened. Everything's fine. For months afterwards, all I could see in my head was him at the bottom of the pool. Now, I feel that's my first experience with my children, of experience actual anxiety, keep you up at night, yeah. can't cope. So after everything you've been through, have you got quite good and pragmatic about looking at the positive outcomes of things?
I think I've got more resilient. And so, you know, I'm not immune. I'm certainly not immune to anxiety. I have anxiety all the time, often. But I'm not immune to depression. I think the difference is now I understand myself a mm-hmm. bit more. I understand the patterns of time. I understand the weather system of my own brain. And also, I think the key thing in my recovery, if there's one thing which made me recover, even though it didn't make me better, because I don't believe in being better or 100% mentally well, just right. as no one's 100% physically well, unless you're like Thor or something, you know, there's always something going on. There's always a fluctuation. That doesn't mean we're necessarily ill. It just doesn't mean we're like 100%. And so we're never 100%. So that was an important thing for me to actually realize that, you know, it's not about being better or ill, you know, there's shades uh-huh. in between. And because it was important for me, because when I was ill, I desperately didn't want to be ill. When I was suicidally ill, I didn't want to be ill. So the moment I stopped feeling that bad, I thought, that's it, I'm better. Mm-hmm. And then the moment you realize you're not better, you get back to sort of like square one again. So I think that was part of it, just realizing it's just this sort of garden that you have to tend to, and that it's never something you never have to think about uh-huh. again. And I think the other thing is the separation between feeling really bad at any one point in time and yourself. You know, it's an experience. That's not to belittle it in any way, because mm-hmm. depression is very serious and it takes people's lives, and it's horrendous to live through full-blown severe depression. But at the same time, even if it's totally consuming you, it's not you. You know, there was a you before it.
Right.
And it operates inside you. You don't operate inside it. If you weren't here, it wouldn't exist. And therefore, it's kind of like weather. So if you're caught in a hurricane, that hurricane can be life-threatening, it can be horrendous, but you kind of know you're not the hurricane.
Yes.
And you also know the hurricane won't be here forever, and it wasn't here forever. And obviously, some people are prone to depression throughout their whole lives. Some people have anxiety all their lives. But for me, that separation of feeling and being was quite important.
Yeah. So in terms of your life beyond that experience in Spain, and not even necessarily referring to your mental health in any way at all, but tell me about an unlucky moment in your life where you think... Yeah, that was just unlucky.
Ah, okay. Unlucky, unlucky. Wow, there's loads of boring career stuff.
That's all right. I'm into the career stuff.
Oh, that's really, really hard. I can think of moments of luck where I've... Because to be unlucky, it feels like... I don't know if I ever feel like that anymore. I don't... Because I feel like... It can lead to sort of like thinking, oh, woe is me.
Yes.
But, you know, I've had bad things happen to me, but I don't know if it's bad luck. It's just things. And I don't know if good things happen because of good luck.
Well, do you believe in luck as a concept?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, I suppose coincidences happen and chance is obvious. But I don't believe you are a lucky person or mm-hmm. an unlucky person. I believe that's something that's... perspective.
Definitely is. And also, do you think there's something in the way that someone would say to you seem very lucky because of your career and like you said, but to an unpublished writer,
yeah, I know,
you're very lucky. However, I think that diminishes your hard work,
and also they're not seeing, you know, successful people are sometimes just the people who failed more and risked failing more, and just, you know, and it's like, you know, I don't think I'm abnormal in this, but I had about 40 rejection letters and I just kept on going. The weird thing is about getting over a breakdown when you're still quite young, you just kind of feel like I can do anything now,
because right.
I was going to die and I didn't die, and I was convinced I would die and I didn't. So getting published is nothing to that. So I'll just go out and keep going until I get published. And, you know, the arrogance of youth and everything.
But also, not just the arrogance of youth, like hugely coming over a hurdle like that and coming out the other side. It's, of course, that gives you a new perspective on, is it what's important, or that just because you didn't like my work doesn't mean my work doesn't exist. Like, it's, I can still keep going.
And I think there was something, like, I also kind of put a fence around myself then. Like, not in the sense that I was guarding anything about myself, mm-hmm. but in the sense that I wasn't going to let certain things get to me. And I didn't care about rejection. I got to a point where I was looking forward to rejection letters. I don't know how I got into that state of mind.
Talk to me about that, because I feel like that's the lesson we all need. How do we look forward to a rejection letter?
Because I knew rejection was part of the process. So it was like the process was happening. These were real literary agents in London when I was just in a little flat in Leeds. And I thought, oh, this is because I'm actually doing something and trying to get something. So this is part of the process. When it was an agent saying some constructive advice and they'd actually read it, I thought, oh, this is great. This is my creative writing course and I'm learning.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, sometimes it was a rejection, but one of those hopeful kind of rejections. And then that would spur you on as well. And I used to go downstairs, look forward to it, and I knew before I opened the envelope that it was rejection letters, but I don't know. I just thought, well, there's more agents, more rejections, and eventually there might be not. But
eventually,
I don't know. I don't know, really.
No, is it
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Same kind of attitude towards like the bad Amazon reviews and the mean tweets.
I'm not good, to be honest. That's a bit different for me. I'm this weird combination of really opinionated and really sensitive. At the same time, it's just a really bad mix. So with reviews, you know, I'd love to, you know, people say don't read reviews, and I don't read all reviews, and I don't know what you're like, but
I read everything.
Okay, good.
Everything. And it's just the worst thing to do. I read everything obsessively, and it's terrible. It's terrible. But also, I mean, I think when you write or when you put anything out there, you need to know what people are saying about it, the good and the bad. You need to know. Like, if there's one bad review that keeps circulating or one thing that multiple people have said about your work, you need to know about it. And it doesn't mean you have to change it, but it's sometimes it's helpful.
Yeah, sometimes.
But it's also horrible.
But it's also
I'm trying
horrible.
To spin that, you see.
The last 2 months have been the worst in my life for negative coverage. I mean, you being a public eye kind of person, you're more used to it. But I had the Daily Express call this chapter I wrote, which was chosen by Meghan Markle in the Vogue issue that she edited. Daily Express said, "This is the worst poem ever written by anyone." And A is not poem. B, piss off. And C, you know, it's just like, you know, why is it people's jobs? You know, why did people go through their journalism degree and come out and just think, right, what am I going to be nasty about Meghan Markle today?
That reaction to her voting, I couldn't believe it was happening.
I mean, you know much more about how tabloids and things work, but I start to ask, what a weird, malicious kind of
and it's horrible thing. When you accidentally find yourself caught up in it. So you know, you contribute something or get asked to do something for Vogue, and then suddenly you're in this horrible tabloid bitch fest. So did you get, after that, did you get quite a lot of grief on Twitter from just general people?
Yeah, just general people. Just, I mean, mainly, you know, kind of people who just have Union Jacks as their profile picture, which you kind of learn to just ignore that because, you know, it's that cliche about never taking criticism from people you wouldn't ask for advice.
Right. That's a really sound piece of advice.
It is good, isn't it? Because you think, why is that? You know, if I wanted to know something, I would not go to this person with 7,000 racist hashtags in their bio.
Uh-huh.
So why am I bothered about, you know, and then you rationalise yourself, I'm not actually that bothered about that. Then I think the things that sort of get through, there's this really nasty Times review. This was way before the Meghan Markle stuff, about Notes on a Nervous Planet when it came out. And it got through because it was personal. It wasn't really reviewing the book, it was reviewing me.
What did it say?
It was saying, you know, Matt Haig had an anxiety in Ibiza that nearly made him want to jump off a cliff. He had a panic attack in a tapas bar in Seville. So, you know, Haig thinks his problems are universal, but my advice to him would be maybe stay away from Spain. And it's just like, you know, you would not say that about any physical condition. So then and there's this silent rule where you're not meant to ever respond to your critics. And it's like, well,
No. We're more powerful. I think, honestly, when you've got something like Twitter and social media, it's to protect people who horrible things are said about. It happened to me once about, oh God, it was ages ago, probably about 7 years ago. There was a little group on group of journalists on Twitter at the time who were being quite just nasty about me. And then one of them had just thought, haha, I know what I'll do. I'll write this really scathing, completely stupid and weird attack on Dawn. Yeah. And I read it and I was like, oh my God, what the hell is happening? And then I went on to Twitter and had so much support. You said people wouldn't say that about a physical condition, but I'd made a documentary about breast cancer, and she's, because my mum died of it, and it was about me kind of looking at the genetics of it and like learning all about it. And then she said that basically there was some line where the only reason I made it was to admire my own breasts in the mirror. I was getting a fucking mammogram. I was honestly so angry because she just diminished this like very painful TV show that I'd done. Anyway, I had that moment of thinking, you're supposed to stay quiet. And then I was like, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You couldn't think of anything to write about this week. And so what you did was you picked me and you attacked me, and I'm going at you on Twitter.
And it's like people say, oh, you must have searched it out, or you searched it. It's like, well, yeah, it's like I've got a book coming out, so I'm looking at my own reaction to this very important thing that I did and put out in the world. And you'd be doing the same thing, and this continual sort of game of gotcha.
Yeah,
and like,
yes, oh, this makes that's how it feels. Also, of course, people read their reviews. That's not something new. That's not something, you know, 100 years ago, writers were like, oh, I had a bad review. It's like, we've always read our own reviews. I honest to God, don't believe a single person who says they don't. I don't. Maybe like the Beckhams have got to a point where they don't feel they need to. But when we know, we're going to read our reviews.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose obviously you get to a point where you get so much media about you, you can't read it all. But I bet you still dip in.
Yes,
I mean,
of course
you. It's like you care. I mean, that's why I don't get. You know, it's publication has the word public in it, so you're putting it out into the public and you're wanting to know what sort of reaction it has, or you would literally keep it under your bed. So yeah, you care about these things. But I think the actual traditional media is a little bit less important now that we can all have our say,
yes,
and respond to it.
We have the right to respond, not to be afraid of it.
Not to be afraid of it. And yeah, I always see sort of writers saying the golden rule is you should never, you know, it looks so petty. And it's like, you know what? Why is it more legitimate to spend an afternoon being nasty about something than a lazy piece of journalism? Why is that a legitimate last word than the months or years or life you spent pouring into something?
And that's exactly right. And I think there's such a difference as well. And people should know better now because of books like yours and because of the conversation around mental health. People should know better. You can criticize my book all you like. You can write a review and not like it, but that doesn't need to slide into a few sentences in that
review.
Your
book's 5 stars, Dawn, anyway.
Thank you. But you know where you start to attack... Yeah. I'm just using me as an example, attack the author personally because of something you didn't like about them. Like, we know better. Mm. And I think that's really important to understand. And people who don't know better and are still doing those kind of crass, horrible old, like, tabloid, disgusting forms of journalism should just be called up on it.
Yeah.
Let's go get them. Power to the people.
Yeah, and it's that moral high ground hypocrisy, you know, that, you know, Piers Morgan's kind of trademark. That idea, you know, that sort of righteous thing where while also just being totally... bitchy and
it's excuse. And also the big one that gets really pisses me off is when people are like, I'm just saying, just being honest. It's like, no, you're just tagging just being honest to a horrible comment to try and justify it. But you get a lot of that, especially on Twitter. I think you're really, and look, I think your hair looks shit like that, and you just really should never dress like that again. I'm just being honest. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, but who are you? You didn't need to tell me.
And I discovered I shouldn't have done this, but this is what ego searching ended up in this sort of like spiral. Well, I discovered this website called Tattle, which is just people being bitchy about celebrities and famous people, and like the whole thread, and there's not literally a positive comment about any of them. And like I was on there, so I thought, oh, am I a celebrity now? Well, this is interesting. And then like just nastiness,
oh,
and it's
God.
Like, but then you just, the easy way to do it is see what they're saying about other people. You think, well, that other person's okay, and they're being equally vindictive about that. It sounds really pathetic, but it is kind of envy. It's not justified envy. Uh-huh. They don't actually realize that people are human beings and have exactly the sort of same ups and downs and fluctuations that everyone else does.
Yeah.
But if you've never had what they imagine that is, then I suppose it's a way to say, well, my problems are because of a lack of something.
Yeah. And do you think that, because the truth is, people do read the comments after the articles and they do read the terrible things. Do you think people would be different if they thought for 1 minute that that person is going to read it? I guess Twitter is the... explains it, yes, actually. Yeah, they would just do exactly the same thing.
But I think maybe, but I think they wouldn't do it like the way we're sitting now. But I feel like there's something that's not quite fully human about the digital world anyway, where people forget. And I think it's to do with the numbers. There's so many people in our lives now. If you can include all the people we don't know, mm-hmm. but we do know of, you know, all the celebrities, you know, you can't, I suppose you run out of ability to care for literally every single thing. So occasionally our interactions become a bit dehumanized, and Twitter's very good at that. Like there's some clever Oxford or Cambridge person who came up with his number of 150 being the amount of people we're meant to meaningfully know in our entire life.
That's such an interesting number.
Because
that's basically a wedding guest list. It's kind of in the right ballpark, isn't it?
150, yeah. Because that was like in hunter-gatherer communities in caveman days, there's 150 people roughly in the sort of sites which are discovered. In the Doomsday Book, the average size of a village up until then was 150. Right throughout Europe, up until the like 1900 or something, the average size of the average community was 150 people. I feel like now you can go on Instagram and encounter 150 new people before you're even, you know, out of bed.
Yeah.
Or gone to the loo. You can like see 150 people. And, you know, we're probably not programmed for that. So this is kind of like...
It's overwhelming.
It's like our hardware malfunctioning by just being nasty to each other on the internet or something.
But it's so addictive. Why can't we leave? Why can't we leave?
I honestly, nothing makes me feel more self-loathing in the daily routine than the amount of time I have spent on either Twitter or Instagram.
I know. And also the all of that, also how productive I would have been, but also the just the oversharing. Sometimes I get into bed and I was like,
why did I
have to post about my bra strap color today? Like, who gives a shit? Why did I have to share it? It's because I'm bored, I'm on my own, I've got my phone, I have a source of entertainment to create some kind of conversation. I've got nothing to say, so I'm going to take a picture of my side boob, which I did not very long ago. I'm like, posted, done. And then I get into bed that night and like, my side boob. Firstly, it's nothing to show off about post two kids.
Yeah,
very disappointing side boob.
I relate to that. Not so much the side boob, but I do relate to the oversharing and the feeling after. And it's sometimes even worse when people are saying, oh, yeah, you're so brave for sharing that. And you think, I wasn't really. Yeah. I was just being stupid. I was just wanting a bit of attention in that moment.
Exactly. How would you define luck?
I think luck is, it's about perspective. So I think like you can have the exact same day and see it as unlucky or lucky. And so I think it's as subjective as anything else, really, luck, which is a bit of a lame answer, isn't it?
No, I think it's the exact answer. I think it's so true. And as I kind of think about the concept of it when I'm asking these questions, I think there can be an opportunity that's presented to you that can be seen as lucky, and then it's absolutely how you follow up that opportunity as to whether it ends up being a positive or a negative thing, and none of what happens next is luck.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that is very, very, something can be a gift or a curse depending on how you... And often what actually initially looks like bad luck is good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm even grateful for being 24 years old wanting to throw myself off a cliff in Ibiza. I'm, you know, that was definitely not lucky, and that was not a thing I would want to relive. But I'm grateful for it because loads of the good things that came after it would not have happened without that bad thing.
Right.
So, you know, there's no such thing as a life of rainbows and unicorns where everything's happy and perfect all the time. But it's how you deal with the bad stuff that mm-hmm. can give you the inverted commas lucky stuff.
Is there anyone that you observe that you consider to be very lucky?
Yeah, it's never like famous people. It's just like my dad, actually. I'm going to say my dad because he has all kinds of things happen. He's had so many near-death experiences on holiday. He's epileptic, so he's had like lots of things. Like he went on holiday to Norway and he had this sort of seizure in a fjord and he sort of blacked out. And he was very lucky because he was in Norway, and everyone in Norway knows CPR, knows how to save a life. So even though there weren't many people around the fjord, he had his life saved. But he's not lucky because of those sort of things. He's lucky because however tough things are or whatever it is, his perspective on it is just so fine. You know, he'll never hit a total low point about anything and get beat. And I think they're the lucky people who have that sort of inner ability to survive and thrive with whatever they're given.
God, your dad having epilepsy, that's frightening.
Yeah, and my granddad did. So statistically, I possibly do, although you don't have epilepsy unless you've had a seizure. I haven't had a seizure, although I do get really bad migraines. But yeah, that's another thing that gives me anxiety.
Migraines?
Well,
the fact that I have
migraines, and then I think, oh, it's a symptom of something. But yeah, any physical symptom I get, I always catastrophize.
Right.
Whatever. You know, I've been dying of so many things this year. What's my latest? Oh, yeah, because I've been tired. I've been thinking about that must mean I'm dying. But then I realize it's probably because I've been going to bed at 1 a.m. for quite a few nights.
Right.
So
why going to bed at 1 a.m.? What's going on?
Children who at the moment are needing one or both parents to get them to sleep.
Right.
And they go to sleep at like 11, and then for me you've got to have at least 2 hours of evening, and so we've gone down and watched Netflix or whatever, and then it's suddenly 1 o'clock.
Yeah,
so that's not good.
And I've heard you talking about how important sleep
is. But
you
don't do that now, you're LA.
I don't really. Chris is like a night owl, so I, you know, very often go to bed early and he'll stay up quite happily till midnight or 1 a.m. Yeah. I just can't. The kids are up at 6, like Valentine was awake at 6 o'clock this morning. Okay. And he just up in his God, he just goes, "Mommy!" from the second he wakes
How old?
Up. He's 2.
Right.
Oh, I mean, okay. it's just.
Yeah, you can't. I wasn't doing it when we were 2.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like to think that I won't be going to bed at 10 for the rest of my life. But I think 11 o'clock is the perfect bedtime to like live
yes,
good life.
Good balanced life without being trashed for the next day. Yes. Normally we're before midnight people, but just recently. Yeah. Netflix is affecting people's sleep, I think, and TV.
Oh, definitely. Was it you I was listening to saying that somewhere? Was it on Dolly's podcast or
possibly,
somewhere?
Yes, about how, what's his name, head of Netflix, said semi-jokingly that Netflix's main competitor isn't Amazon, it's sleep.
Yes,
it's
I mean, not, God.
You know, it is, and we're very good at it, aren't we, with a little countdown, and then you're not even watching the credits and you're into the next show. And yeah.
Yeah, you're like, just one more. I can see I've got one more in me. Anyway, on that note, speaking of the end of one show, we'll end this show. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dawn. That was lovely.
Massive thanks again to Matt for talking to me on the podcast. Matt's brilliant book, Notes on a Nervous Planet, is out in paperback now, as is his latest children's book, The Truth Pixie Goes to School. I've got some fantastic conversations lined up for you on So Lucky, so please do make sure you're subscribed to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on your smart speaker of choice to get each one as it drops. I'm just like Beyonce. If you enjoyed this conversation, I'd really appreciate you leaving a review on whatever platform you use to listen to this, because it really helps other people find the podcast. And if you enjoy the conversation of getting behind the veneer that people put out there to the world, then you might enjoy my new novel, also called So Lucky, out now. Thanks again to Matt, to producer Emma Corsham at Rethink Audio, to Fanula, to Liz, to Kim, and all of the team at HarperCollins, and to you for listening. See you next week.